Bonjour. Thank you all for coming. So, in the last presentation, I talked about general features of sensory transductions, general features of the mechanism by which we convert energies in the surrounding world into specific signals in our nervous systems that then represent our sensations in the brain. And today I wish to discuss in more detail one sensory system, which is hearing, and also the related system of balance. And the motivation for understanding this has really two components. First, in this society, throughout Europe, throughout all the industrialized world, in fact, there are a large number of people with hearing problems. Approximately 10% of people have some difficulty in understanding speech, for example, on the telephone or in a crowded environment. And this number is, in fact, increasing as a result of the pollution of sound in the environment, loud noises of all sorts. So it is very important that we understand as soon as possible what causes this damage, whether the damage can be prevented or whether the damage can be reversed. And in fact, it's laboratories like that of Christine Petit that have been most important in demonstrating what are the genes involved in the normal function of the ear, and what are the genes involved in many sorts of pathology. In addition to the clinical motivation, from the point of view of basic research, there is a strong interest in the ear's remarkable technical qualities, and there are three that I'll mention. First, we can hear sounds at frequencies as high as 20 kilohertz, 20,000 cycles per second. And bats and whales can hear 100 kilohertz, which is 1/10 of a megahertz, which is extraordinary for a biological device. When you think about it, our other senses are about 1,000 times slower. For example, if you see a television or a film, then you are seeing images that are 30 frames per second or 24 frames per second. And yet that seems like a continuous image because the visual system cannot process so fast. Somehow the auditory system moves 1,000 times faster. The second technical specification is that the system is very mechanically sensitive. So the very faintest sounds that you can hear vibrate the apparatus in the ear by only about 1/3 of 1 nanometers. That is 1 to 3 angstrom. It is the size of a single atom. So one wonders how something that is made of proteins and fats and so on can reliably detect an atomic size of vibration. And the third specification is the enormous dynamic range of our hearing. We can hear sounds from 0 decibels, approximately, to about 120 decibels, which would be a very loud airplane, say, leaving a Charles de Gaulle or something. That is 6 orders of magnitude, 1 millionfold in the amplitude of the sound, or 12 orders of magnitude, 10 to the 12th, or 1 trillionfold in the power of the sound that you're tolerating. And I don't know of any other transducer, a human-made transducer or a biological transducer, that can encompass 12 orders of magnitude in the stimulus power. So what I want to do in today's presentation is to talk about the basic apparatus that accomplishes these feats. And I will be talking specifically about the hair cell. The hair cell, as you will see, is the specialized receptor of the ear, responsible both for our hearing, but also for our balance, for our sense of linear acceleration, for our sense of angular acceleration. The cells are very similar and operate in a similar way. In the next week's lecture, I will talk about the more complicated apparatus of the cochlea itself, because that has additional features that enable us to detect sound of different frequencies, to separate it, and to analyze the different components. And that is a very complex operation that I think merits a separate lecture. So today's presentation will focus just on the one step of the progression that I mentioned last time. Senses in general have inputs that are somehow captured. The signal is transduced into some sort of chemical or electrical signal. It is farther amplified. Finally, it is encoded as a series of nerve impulses before it is exported, sent into the brain for interpretation. And today I'll talk just about transduction in the ear. And the cell that accomplishes this is the hair cell. The hair cell is a cylinder. It does not have an axon or dendrites, but it does make chemical synapses The synapses are at its base, and it contacts nerve fibers such as these that carry information into the brain. And in fact, in my final lecture in 2 weeks, I'll talk about this synaptic apparatus. Today, I wish to focus on the hair bundle. The hair bundle is this cluster of small processes, small rods, that come from the top surface of the cell's apex. These stand about, in this case, 8 micrometers from the cell's surface. And this apparatus can be seen best by looking at it from above in the scanning electron microscope. You then see this very beautiful regular structure. In every case, these processes are of two types. One group, which are these, are called stereocilia. And this name means a stiff or rigid hair. And there is also one process only at the tall edge that is called the kinocilium or kinocilium. It has a ball on the end in this case, and it's a little bit shorter than the very longest ones you see here. There are two important things about this hair bundle that I want to call to your attention. One is that these stereocilia do not stand like this. They always come together, so they touch at their tips. And that is very important for the way this apparatus works. The other general feature is that the stereocilia are not all of the same size. In every case, the stereocilia are short, and then they grow monotonically longer as you move across the bundle. So this looks like a hypodermic needle. It has a bevel or an angle to it, and every hair bundle has this quality. It has a vector along one axis that distinguishes it from the other two axes. Now, if we cut across this hair bundle about halfway, we see two other features. First, these stereocilia are always on very regular hexagonal axes, as you see here. And secondly, the stereocilia are very distinct from the single kinocilium. The stereocilia have at their core actin filaments, about 300 or 400 actin filaments in this case. And this actin is highly cross-linked so that it's very stiff. The kinocilium instead has microtubules. It has a so-called axoneme, which is like the microtubule apparatus on the tails of sperm, on the cells of your bronchus that remove dirt from your lungs, and so on. So this kinocilium is potentially able to move independently, and this is why it has the name kino or kino, indicating its ability to move. If you look at the bottom of each of these stereocilia, it tapers, it becomes smaller, so it is somewhat like a pencil that is stuck with its sharp end into the top surface of the cell. Here, as I said, there are 300 or 400 filaments, but here only about 20. And as a consequence, this structure is most flexible or compliant at its base. So that if you touch a living hair bundle, such as this one, with a fiber, this is a glass rod, then you can see two interesting things about the movement. First, these processes, these stereocilia, do not bend on their length. They stay quite straight, but instead they pivot at their base. And secondly, the whole hair bundle moves as an ensemble. It does not separate. So this means that as these processes move, they must slide with respect to each other. There's a shearing motion. And that is very important in the way that the transduction process works in these cells. So if one moves the hair bundle with a stimulus fiber back and forth like this and records from the cell, one can measure an electrical response. So the electrical response is in the range of a few millivolts, perhaps 30 millivolts at the most. A small stimulus like this one produces a small response that's rather linear. And as the stimulus gets larger, the response reaches a saturating level in both the depolarizing and the hyperpolarizing direction. Because one can control the hair bundle's motion with a fiber as a function of time, and simultaneously measure the response, one can make a graph of the relation of the displacement and the response. And such a graph is shown for 7 cells here. And the main point that I wish to make is that the graph is rather narrow. In this case, the channels go, or the electrical response goes from almost 0 to a maximum over a distance of about 0.2 micrometers or 200 nanometers. And as we'll see later, it can be even sharper than that. So the sensitivity of the system is very high. In the diagrams, I'll show you the hair bundle moving a large distance. The reality is it moves only about 1 diameter at the most for the largest cell. And in fact, the threshold stimulus, which is 0.3 of a nanometer, is about 1/1000th of a degree. So this is the same as moving about this far at the top of the Eiffel Tower. It is a very, very small deflection indeed, almost invisible. There is also a vectorial sensitivity to this. If we move the hair bundle back and forth in its plane of symmetry from the short side to the tall side where the canocillium lives, we get a maximum response, as I've already shown you. But if instead we move at a right angle, we get no response at all. And in general, if we move at some oblique angle, we get a smaller response that varies as the cosine of this angle. So this says that there is a vectorial apparatus here. If we have a stimulus such as this, there is a response to this component, but not a response to the orthogonal component. And this is valuable in our vestibular apparatus because it means that an ensemble of these cells that are sensitive in different directions can report accurately the direction in which one moves. So if I close my eyes and walk around, I can integrate the different accelerations in different directions, and like an inertial guidance system in a missile or an airplane, I can come back to where I started. We're doing this all of the time, even though we don't think about it. We constantly integrate these signals and the rotatory signals to know where our bodies are in space and to keep upright. Now, these responses come from ion channels. The ion channels are called mechano-electrical transduction channels. They change mechanical stimulus into an electrical response. And one can estimate the number of these channels by a technique called ensemble variance or noise analysis. In this technique, one moves the hair bundle back and forth sinusoidally and then measures the electrical current that flows into the cell. Now, this current might come from one enormous channel, so the channel might be closed or open or going between the two, or maybe there are two channels and each of them can be closed or both of them can be open, or there could be 10 or 100. Whatever it is, you can compare these different records, and by examining the noise in the record, you can distinguish these. The more noise, the fewer channels. So there is a rigorous analysis of this that I'll show you in a moment, done by Erwin Nair and Fred Sigworth. In the experiment, we push the hair bundle, open the channels, we see a certain current, then we let the hair bundle relax and the current goes away. If we average many of these records, more than 100, we get a smooth curve like this. The mean current is proportional to the number of channels, the probability that they're open, and the current through a single channel. If we take each of these records, say this one, and we subtract it from this mean and amplify the result, we get these noise records over here, the variance. And you can see that the variance has peaks. There's a lot of variance here, but not so much here, not so much there. Similarly, there's more variance here, and here, here, and here. If you average the variance of all of these, you get two peaks, one when the channel's open, one when the channel's close. And the prediction of the analysis is there should be a parabolic relationship between the mean and the variance. The variance, as you can see, has this relationship to the mean, which is large I. The nice thing about this relation is that one has eliminated the unknown variable P from the relationship. And you can see the data fit very nicely with the predicted parabola. And from this, one can infer in this cell, there were about 90 of these channels. Now, these hair bundles have, the ones that I'm using here from the frog, have about 60 stereo cilia, and they have contacts between stereo cilia totaling about 40. So this suggests that there are approximately twice as many channels as there are stereo cilia. And in fact, if you break the hair bundle, you find that the current gets smaller in proportion to the number of stereo cilia that has been damaged. So it seems that each stereo cilium has a few channels, probably two associated with it. Now that's been studied in greater detail by Robert Fetterplace and his colleagues. They were able to measure from cells the opening and closing of individual channels and to notice their conductance, that is how much current each of these channels can pass. And the conductances are rather large. They go up to 300 picosiemens, which is a very high current indeed. Another group, that of Jeff Holt, has recently shown that different types of hair cells have different conductances. These are about 250 picosiemens. These are about 125. And in some cells of different type, you can see clusters of different conductances, as though they're different kinds of channels in different combinations. These channels are called TMC channels, which is transmembrane channel, not a very exciting name. And the fact that they occur in these different clusters of conductance, even though there are only two genes involved, suggests that they may occur in different combinations. So hypothetically, one might get four of one type, or four of the other type, or various combinations, 3+1, 1+3, 2+2, in different combinations, and so on. And the hypothesis is that these will have different conductances. This might have a low conductance, this might have a high conductance, and others would be graded in between. So this now needs to be confirmed, and people are doing experiments to try to prove it. These responses in hair cells are very fast. I won't show you the kinetics, but they gate or open in only tens of microseconds, so fast that it's very difficult for us to measure them. So this led us to an hypothesis with David Corey that the mechanical deflection of the hair bundle directly opens the channel. We suppose that the channel, which you see here in red, has some sort of a molecular gate and a spring to hold it closed. It sits in the membrane, shown in white. And somehow, when you apply a force to the hair bundle, that force is communicated through an elastic structure called the gating spring, which makes the channel pop open. And we then set about to learn how this model might actually occur within the cell. So the first question is, where are these channels? And this we studied by moving the hair bundle back and forth and measuring the extracellular current flowing into the cell. If one measures near the base of the cell, where the stereocilia are bending, the signals which are shown here, or averages are shown here, they're rather small. At the top, on the other hand, the signals are uniformly larger. So it acts as though the apparatus for transduction is here at the top, which was something of a surprise when this was first shown. In fact, because it was controversial, we studied it two other ways. A second way is to block the channel with a drug. There are drugs such as the aminoglycosides, gentamicin, neomycin, and so on. They block this channel temporarily. So in this experiment, we could move the hair bundle back and forth, and then we had a second electrode, which came in this direction to spray the drug onto the hair bundle. And we could then move that electrode to each of these different positions, here, 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 and ask where the blockage is most effective. So when the hair bundle is moved, which is this displacement record, we see a current into the cell, which is this rather square record. But if the drug administered here blocks some channels, then the response gets smaller temporarily until the drug diffuses away. So the difference between the control record and the drug record tells you how effective the drug is at some particular position. So when the drug is applied in many places, putting the drug here on line 7 or line 6, there's very little blockage. These records are almost square. On the other hand, if we put the drug in positions 2 or positions 3, you can see that the blockage is quite strong. So again, it suggests the channels are at this point. And finally, one can fill the cells in a different experiment with a calcium indicator. The calcium indicator tells you where calcium is flowing into the cell, and we know calcium flows through the transduction channel. So here is an image of the hair bundle. The probe moves the bundle back and forth. When the hair bundle is at rest, we see a little bit of signal at the top of the bundle, again suggesting some channels are open and calcium is flowing in. When we move the hair bundle in the positive direction here, we see now a lot of current go into the cell. We see a lot of calcium entering, and it begins here at the top. It has the strongest signal. Now this comes to equilibrium. The signal becomes weaker, and when the channels close, again, the signal dissipates, except at the top. So clearly, the action, the response, is originating at the top of the hair bundle. And in fact, at the time these experiments were done, another group, that of James Pickles, found a morphological correlate for the transduction apparatus. This is the so-called tip link, which is a fine strand of molecules connecting the tip of each stereocilium to the side of the longer stereocilium adjacent. And here you can see another such thing. Christine's group was among those that characterized the molecules involved. This is a dimer of dimers, so the upper half of it consists of two molecules of cadherin-23, which is an extracellular linking protein. The lower half is two molecules of protocadherin-15, another member of the cadherin family. And in fact, another group, that of Tony Ricci, has subsequently confirmed in more detail that the site of the transduction is at the bottom end of the tip link, because previously there was an ambiguity. Might the channels be here? Might the channels be there? Or might they be at both ends, as some evidence suggested? But they used, again, a calcium indicator and found that the calcium indicator in stereocilia that have 1, 2, 3 rows lights up the stereocilia at the top of the second row, but not along the sides of the first row. So it suggests that there are channels here and there are channels here, but they're not channels at the tall end because this stereocilium gets no calcium signal. So we believe there are two channels and they're at the bottom of the tip link. So here's a simple model for how this apparatus works. The hair bundle has a number of stereocilia. Along one axis, from the short to the tall, there are a row of these tip links. And these tip links are attached, we believe, to two channels in each case. The channels are usually closed when the hair bundle is resting. But when we apply a mechanical stimulus, this makes a shearing between the hair bundles. This, in turn, applies tension in the tip links. The tip links pull the channels open, and now ions can flow in, down the stereocilia, and excite the cell to release a neurotransmitter. The main advantage of this mechanism is that it's very fast. There are no second messengers. There are no chemical signals involved. The time scale is simply set by how fast you can move the bundle and how fast the channels can pop open, which is very fast indeed. Now, this model also makes an interesting prediction that it was possible to test. And that prediction is that there should be a mechanical correlate of the transduction process. So the idea is this. Suppose you have a channel like this one. It has a hole, which is the ion pore. It has a gate, which can be open or closed. And it has a tip link, an elastic element attached to it. If this channel is at the top of this stereocilium, and there's another longer stereocilium here, then you have a system like this. When you listen to a sound, the apparatus moves this way, the channel opens and closes and lets a little bit of current flow in. The prediction is that if you came and pushed on my arms, as you pushed, you would do a certain amount of work elongating the rubber band. And it's the same amount of work if the channel is closed or if the channel is open. It's identical rubber band. But something interesting happens if you begin to push while the channel is closed, and while you're pushing, it opens. Now this rubber band will be slack. It will lose tension as a result of the swing of this channel's gate. So there should be a statistical mechanical effect, a softening of the hair bundle that is associated with the transduction process itself. So it's possible to test this by measuring the force in the hair bundle. And that is done by applying a very fine glass rod to the hair bundle and making it adhere. So here's the top of the hair bundle with the canocilium and its bulb at its top. There is a chemical reaction between the fiber and the hair bundle that makes these two stick together tightly. One can then cast an image onto a photodiode and measure motion of the hair bundle with a precision better than 1 nanometer and a frequency response of more than 1 kilohertz. The other thing that one can do is to move the base of the fiber with a stimulator. When one does that, the hair bundle is pulled in the same direction, but because the fiber is elastic, it is also bent in the opposite direction. So if you measure the bending, the difference between the motion here and here, and if you know how stiff the fiber is, you can calculate how much force the hair bundle produces. And when you do that, you find the effect we were seeking. The hair bundle is not elastic in a linear way. It is not Hookian. Hooke's law says there should be a linear relationship between force and displacement, which is what I'm drawing now. But as you can see, this curve very definitely does not have that property. It has a linear segment here, and then sort of a segue to a new linear segment over here. And this is what we expect, a softening of the hair bundle over the position in which the channels are beginning to open. From such records, it's possible to make estimates of several parameters. Again, the estimate is about 50 channels in this case, so similar to the number of stereocilia. The expectation is that the gate opens through a distance of about 2 nanometers, which is a realistic channel size. that the restoring force is about 2 piconewtons, and that the stiffness of the spring is about 1 millinewton per meter. And that's similar to the stiffness of many protein molecules that have been studied by laser tweezers and other techniques. Now, there's an interesting consequence of this nonlinearity, which was discovered already in 1714 by the violinist Tartini. What Tartini noticed is that if he was tuning his violin, if he played 2 frequencies, a high frequency F2 and a lower frequency F1, he could hear the 2 frequencies that he was playing, but he could also hear other frequencies that he knew his violin was not playing. He could hear F2 plus or minus F1, twice F2 plus or minus F1, twice F1 plus or minus F2. So these are not harmonics. These are anharmonic tones that are being somehow produced. And the evidence is that they're being produced in the ear of the listener. And you can see the rationale for these tones. The relationship I've shown you between force and displacement is like this yellow curve. It's an S-shaped structure. And that is can be fit by some sort of a power law expansion of the sort you show, that I show here. There's a certain linear component, a quadratic component, a cubic component, and so on. Now, if we insert 2 frequencies into this argument, x is equal to this sine frequency and a sine of that frequency, when we make the square term, these 2 signs will be multiplied, and the product of signs will give you things such as F2 plus or minus F1. If we cube it, we will get sine squared of F1 times sine of F2, or sine squared of F2 times sine of F1, and this will give us these cubic distortion products. So in fact, this nonlinearity is expected to give you this type of behavior. There's another stronger reason for these nonlinearities that I'll discuss in the next lecture as well. If one actually does the experiment of stimulating a hair bundle with 2 frequencies and then measuring the forces that the hair bundle produces, one sees not only a response at those frequencies, but responses at all of these other frequencies as well. And in fact, those fit very well with the expectation of the theory that I just showed you. These signals are strong enough that you can hear them. I'll play you a short demonstration to show this. The demonstration will have first a single frequency, which is very boring for 7 seconds, a second frequency that starts at a high level and then declines to a lower frequency, and then the same 2 frequencies simultaneously. And the idea of the demonstration is this. The strongest of these distortion products is twice F1 minus F2. So F1 is here, twice F1 would be up here, but I emphasize it is not being played. Twice F1 minus F2 starts off as the small difference, but then the difference grows larger. So the idea is that the real sounds that you hear will be a constant tone and a descending tone, but particularly at the end, you may hear an ascending tone, and that is being generated in your ear. I promise you it is not in the computer. At least, if it is, I didn't put it there. So that is this one. Now the 2 together, and listen particularly at the end for a rising tone. It's pretty strong, no? I'll do it one more time. So this demonstration can be done better using independent speakers, independent generators, and so on, but it is entirely legitimate. And there are other versions. Pascal Martin has some in which various music, like Frère Jacques, can be played not by playing the melody, but by playing boop, 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 different tones and allowing the tones to interfere this way. In fact, some composers, like Ligeti in Hungary, or Karlheinz Stockhausen in Germany, have made music in which no instrument plays the music. Nothing plays the melody. Instead, the melody is just made from the interference of 2 tone streams of this sort. And I unfortunately don't have a slide, but at least the Stockhausen score I've seen once in a music library. It's extraordinary because the conductor's score has the part of all the instruments. And then at the bottom, there is a staff with dotted notes. And the dotted notes say what you should be hearing, even though nobody is playing them. So this simple theory of gating springs explains a great deal of the behavior and makes other predictions. And I will very rapidly show this complex slide, but do not expect you to remember it. But the theory has really a very simple organization. The idea is that you have a channel with the gate. You have a spring with a certain stiffness. When the spring is connected to the gate, it is elongated by a certain amount. When the hair bundle moves, there's an additional elongation. When the gate opens, there's a relaxation through this distance. And finally, there's an adaptation process that I'll show you later that allows the spring to shorten and reduces the tension. And if one simply uses those simple principles, one predicts that the relationship between displacement and channel opening should follow this Boltzmann-type relation. And depending on the parameters, this may be rather shallow or it may be steeper. One predicts next that there should be this nonlinearity in the stiffness. And an interesting prediction, which seemed impossible at the beginning, is that the stiffness could actually become negative. You could actually have a region in which the change is so great that the stiffness has a region of negativity. And I'll come back to that in a moment. If you take the derivative of this curve to measure stiffness, one expects gating compliance, which is what I've showed you already, the decrease in stiffness when the rat trap opens and closes. And again, in the extreme case, this gating compliance could be so strong that the stiffness actually declines to zero or below zero, and you have something with negative stiffness. So if one measures the response of a very healthy hair cell, one finds that it does have negative stiffness. So this is, in fact, a result from Pascal Martin. You can see a linear component, another linear component, but over this region, a negative slope. Now, when we did this experiment, we thought that's very interesting, but we had no idea what it meant. And so we had to make a cartoon for ourselves to understand what negative stiffness implies. If the hair bundle is at rest, then the fiber attached to it is straight. If you move the base of the fiber far to the right, it pulls on the hair bundle, and the fiber bends back to the left because the hair bundle is exerting a force in the opposite direction. But the interesting behavior occurs if you move the hair bundle just a small distance by pulling the fiber here. Now the hair bundle moves to the right of the fiber. It moves more than it was asked to move. So it's as though I came to this podium and I pushed the podium. Instead of pushing back, the podium pulls me in the same direction. It suggests that the hair bundle has in it an instability that can do work on an external object such as myself. And that is obviously of interest in understanding how the hair bundle is able to amplify sounds, as I'll show you subsequently. Now, we can show that this is a result of channel activity. If we block the channels with a drug, this region of negative stiffness that you can see in the white curves disappears, and the system becomes completely Hookean, completely linear, as long as the channels are closed or blocked. As soon as the drug goes away, then the system again develops its nonlinearity. So somehow it is the transduction channels themselves that give this response. So here's an idea of how it works. The channels, we think, open through some distance, which we call D. They're attached to a spring of stiffness kappa. And let's suppose that three of these channels in this schematic are in parallel with each other. If I apply a force to this ensemble, all three of the springs will be stretched, and each of the channels will feel one-third of the total force. But if now one of the channels opens, this spring will relax, and that means that these two springs must have more tension. And in fact, the amount of additional tension is kappa delta divided by 3. Another channel may now open, in which case this channel has still more force attached to it until it opens also. So the system is unstable. If there's a small force, all the channels will remain closed and the system is happy. If instead there's a large force, all the channels will open. But in between, there is an avalanche behavior. As you begin to pull, first one channel opens and then all the other channels will follow it. And similarly, if you relax the tension slightly, First, one channel will close, and then all the channels will close together. So in physical terms, this relation means that there's a stable fixed point here. The system can sit stably there. There's another stable fixed point here. But here is an unstable fixed point. If you put the bundle at this position, thermal noise will knock it one direction or knock it the other direction to a stable point. In other words, either this point or this point. It cannot reside stably in the regions between. Now, this whole theory assumes that the channels are in parallel with each other. And that is not so obvious, because if you look at the hair bundle, the force is applied here at the canocilium and to these five stereocilia. And then it must propagate across the entire hair bundle to the opposite side. So you might suppose that the force would decrease as it propagates. For example, applying a force here might stretch this tip link, but not so much this one, and less this one, and less this one, and so on. So these would not truly be in parallel, but more in series. What I'm arguing is if they're in parallel, a force applied here must stretch all of the tip links by the same amount and be equally distributed among the channels. There's an important consequence of this. If the channels can separate, if they're in series, then this channel will get first, then this one, and we'll get a series of relations between displacement and open probability. This is the first one to open, this is the second, and so on all the way across. And the average of all of these is a very broad curve. Whereas if they stay in contact, each channel will have identical behavior, and the whole ensemble will have a behavior identical to that of a single channel. Similarly with forces. If this channel gates, then this one, each of them will have a separate force curve. The whole group of them will have a very broad distribution, and that distribution is monotonic. It does not have a region of negative stiffness. Whereas if they all gate together, each individual channel or the whole group of channels will have identical properties, and one can now see this negative stiffness. So it's important to demonstrate what is really happening. We did the demonstration by observing thermal noise, Brownian motion. If the channels are able to separate from each other, then as the bundle moves, it should have breathing motions. The stereocilia should move with respect to each other. So the difference between the red stereocilia and the orange stereocilia at two different times shows gaps opening between the cilia. If, on the other hand, the stereocilia always stay in contact, if they're truly in parallel, the whole apparatus should move always as a unit. So we tested that by making a special interferometer with two beams. There's a red beam and a green beam. They are put together. They're directed onto the specimen onto two small points. Then the two beams are analyzed independently. Each beam is an independent interferometer. One beam or one subbeam, say the green one, has one beam that's polarized this way, another one polarized at a right angle. And similarly, the red beam has two components that are orthogonally polarized. So the idea is by comparing the light falling into these two regions, this or this one, one can measure the edge of the stereocilium as it moves. So if one measures with both beams at the top of the stereocilium, you can see thermal noise moving the hair bundle, and the red and the green beams are undergoing exactly the same motion. The two records are almost identical. The small differences come from the fact that the two lasers have some noise. So you might see, for example, a little peak in noise there in the red beam that's not so prominent in the green beam. Now you can do the experiment in which we put the two beams at the same place and look at the hair bundle's spontaneous motion owing to thermal noise. We then measure the cross correlation between the two beams. We're asking how the position recorded by the two beams changes as a function of time and how the relationship between those two beams changes over a period of milliseconds. And the important point is that the cross correlation in yellow is identical to the autocorrelation of the red beam or the green beam with itself, which is shown as a dotted line in red. So these two beams indeed are seeing exactly the same motion, which they should because they're directed at the same place. But now the real experiment is to move one beam to the opposite side of the bundle. And now we again cross-correlate the result at this beam and that beam. And again we see in the red dotted line, in the yellow line, that the cross-correlation is almost identical to the red autocorrelation of the red beam with itself. So what this is saying is that when the hair bundle moves, it always moves as a unit. You never get opposite motions on the two sides of the bundle. The stereocilia really are in parallel with each other. If we instead move one of these beams to another hair bundle nearby, we now see no correlation anymore, which makes sense. There's no connection of one cell to the next. So there are different ways in which this correlation could occur. The stereocilia are basically elongated microvilli with actin filaments in them. They grow from a terminal web called the cuticular plate, which is an actin gel. This gel ordinarily curves, and that could push the stereocilia together. So they could be forced together. There are elastic connections between the stereocilia, including the tip links. Those could pull them together. They could be held together by electrostatic interactions, because these stereocilia have negative charge, and calcium ions will bind them to each other. Or they could be coupled together by hydrodynamic forces. And we tested each of these ideas. First, the stereocilia are pushed together by bending of the cuticular plate. You can see this curvature in many, many cells. But in fact, if you make a measurement of that, it's too weak to account for the fact that that the hair bundle stays as a unit. There must be something else. They're filamentous connections. They're the tip links I've shown you. They're so-called horizontal top connectors. There are links at the base that are also called ankle links. But one can again show that these do not account for all of the stiffness. In particular, you can easily cut these links and cut these links with enzymes or reduced calcium, and the system still shows similar behavior. You can dissolve this with hypertonic or hypotonic solutions, and again, the hair bundle stays together. So this is not the answer. We did electrophoresis on the stereocilia and found that the electrical charge can't account for it. The answer turns out, in fact, to be a hydrodynamic coupling, something we did not anticipate. We did an elaborate analysis of this, and in fact, Thomas Riesler was instrumental in decomposing this complex structure and looking at the modes of motion among the various stereocilia. We did finite element analysis with Johannes Baumgart in Germany, who had access to a giant computer farm that could do this calculation. So in the finite element analysis, we break up the stereocilia and the surrounding liquid into many, many discrete elements, 50,000 volume elements. They're 800,000 degrees of freedom. And then we solve the Navier-Stokes equation for an incompressible liquid for all of that area. And in brief, what we found is that the hydrodynamic effects are sufficient to hold the hair bundle together. So here's an animation. This is at different frequencies, beginning much below 1 hertz, so very, very low frequencies. We're applying a force just to the top of the canocilium and to the 5 adjacent stereocilia. So at the beginning, only they are moving. These are water molecules in the surroundings. But as we begin to get into the range of auditory frequencies, you notice that all of the stereocilia are now beginning to move together. So with no connections in this model, the hydrodynamic forces are propagating across the bundle and making everything move together. And this is true throughout the auditory range. Only when we get to 100 kilohertz or more do inertial effects begin to interfere. So the reason for this is shown here. If we consider 2 stereocilia, these 2 red ones in the hair bundle, when the hair bundle is moved to your right, those 2 stereocilia have 2 choices. One possibility is that they separate from each other, from the orange position to the red position like that. But to do so, they must suck water into the very small space between the stereocilia. That is energetically very expensive. And in fact, if you put your hands into the bath or into a basin with water, and separate the hands very rapidly, it requires a very large force because you have to suck water into the space between, and there's a very high friction to do this. The other alternative is that the stereocilia can stay in contact with each other and slide longitudinally like that. And in that case, there is no need to pull water between them. The water between them simply stays between them, and it too slides longitudinally. And remarkably, this has a drag coefficient that is only about 1,000th or 1/2,000th of this. So this is a much easier way for systems of this sort to move than this, and this is why it's favored for the motion that I showed you. So what we have at this point is an apparatus that is capable of doing some mechanical work. It has an instability, but it needs a power source. If you want to make an amplifier or you want to make an oscillator, you must have some energy source to make it go. And in fact, there is at least one and probably two energy sources in this apparatus. And I'll discuss today only one of them that operates at relatively low frequencies. And in next week, I'll deal with the other one that operates at higher frequencies. So we can see this energy at work in a simple experiment in which we apply a force to the hair bundle for a few tens of milliseconds and then release it. We see channels open, a surge of current into the cell, but then there's a rapid adaptation. More than half of the channels close in just 1 millisecond. There's then a second slower relaxation with a time constant of 20 to 30 milliseconds. If we simultaneously measure the hair bundle's position, we find that it also has mechanical correlates of these two adaptation components. First, the hair bundle moves in the direction that we push it, but then it jerks rapidly back in the opposite direction. And this occurs in 1 millisecond as most of the channels close. And then secondly, there's a slower relaxation of the hair bundle that is associated with the slow closing of additional channels. This relaxation means that the hair bundle is becoming softer. Again, it's as if I push on this podium with a constant force. Initially, the podium moves some distance, and then with time, it moves farther. It is getting softer. So we thought this softening might reflect the action of a myosin molecule, because we know that the stereocilia are full of actin, and the only family of motors that is known to work on actin are the myosin molecules. So we used what is known about myosins to test the hypothesis. Myosins in general, which is shown by M, bind actin when they're bound with ATP. The ATP is then hydrolyzed to ADP and inorganic phosphate. When the inorganic phosphate leaves, the system enters a series of tightly bound states in which the actin and the myosin are firmly attached to each other, and these are shown in yellow. At the time when the phosphate leaves, this is followed by a power stroke when work is done. Then the ADP leaves, leaving a so-called Rigor complex of tightly bound actin and myosin. And finally, when ATP binds again, we go back to the beginning and the cycle can be repeated. Now, each of these steps is associated with particular predictions. For example, it's possible to photolabel this substrate. This step should require calmodulin or a light chain. This should also require calcium. This step is blocked by analogs of phosphate, such as vanadate, beryllium fluoride, aluminum fluoride, and sulfate. This step is blocked by analogs of ADP, such as ADP beta S. We tested all of these ideas, and in fact, all of them can be confirmed. They're all consistent with the idea that there's some myosin involved in the adaptation process. I'll show you just a couple of the experiments. Here's one in which we have ATP and a pipette recording from a cell. We give a mechanical stimulus, we see current flowing into the cell, and we see this adaptation that I've shown you before. And even 13 minutes later, the adaptation can still occur. If instead we put ADP beta S into the pipette, which is an ADP analog, we find that immediately after we break into the cell, there is adaptation. But just a few seconds later, the adaptation totally vanishes. So it's necessary to have ATP and to have ADP as a consequence of it in the system in order for the adaptation to work. And as I've showed you already, the calcium is present because calcium can come in through the transduction channel. So if we use a scanning microscope, confocal microscope, and move up and down an individual stereocilium while this glass pipette stimulates the hair bundle, what we see is when the stimulus is applied, there is a brightening at the tip of the stereocilium representing calcium flowing in at that point. And that calcium can be estimated in concentration, and indeed the concentration is a few tens of micromolar, which is the right range of calcium concentration to activate calmodulin and myosin molecules. If we do biochemical analysis using the labeling of the substrate in the stereocilia, we find indeed there's a strong band that's labeled at about 120 kilodaltons, and that corresponds in immunohistochemical in immune reactions, Western blots, with a myosin 1C. So it's a small myosin with a single head, And in fact, if one does immunofluorescence, one finds that that myosin is focused along the top edge of the stereocilia, as shown here. Now, a very nice experiment was subsequently done by the group of Peter Gillespie, Jeff Holt, David Corey. What they did is to mutate myosin 1C in hair cells. Ordinarily, the position where ADP or ATP with one more phosphate binds is closed by a large residue, which is a tyrosine, shown here in yellow. And they had the idea that if one removed this tyrosine and replaced it with a glycine, a much smaller residue, one would open a space above this. And so ATP or ADP with a large residue on top, so this is a methylbutyl group, this would now fit, but this would not fit into a normal myosin that has this roof or ceiling over its head. So what they found is that if they used this molecule, this special methylbutyl molecule, in control circumstances, they could put this in and it would not block transduction. And it would not block because this ADP moiety could not fit with the large bulky group sticking out of the top. But if they made the mutant myosin, now the same compound here would block the adaptation. So this very specifically says myosin 1C is somehow involved in this adaptation process. So there may be other myosins as well, particularly myosin 7A. But what we think is at the top of the tip link, there are about 50 molecules of this myosin, and they move up and down these actin filaments, adjusting the tension in the tip link, and therefore the opening of the channel at the other end. And the simple model for the adaptation process that I've just shown you is shown here. When the hair bundle is deflected in the positive direction, there is shearing between the stereocilia that pulls the channels open. But now these myosin molecules slide down the stereocilia. This reduces the tension and allows the channels to close. And so as that occurs, the large current diminishes in the adaptation process. In the opposite direction, pushing the hair bundle in the negative direction initially takes the tension out of the tip links and all the channels shut. But now myosin can burn ATP, pull up, reopen some channels, and you will see some current beginning to flow again. Now, these hair bundles are able to oscillate spontaneously, and I will show you much more detail of that in the subsequent lecture. But this spontaneous oscillation of the stereocilia suggests that this adaptation process must be working continually to move the hair bundle one way or another. In fact, the prediction is this, that as the oscillations occur, when the system is just moved in the negative direction before a positive jump, it's moved in the negative direction because the climbing of the myosins has put more tension in these springs and pulled the hair bundle to the left. And conversely, when the hair bundle has been in the positive direction, this is because the myosin molecules have moved down and the hair bundle has been allowed to relax to the right. So if we take the hair bundle in this position or this position, we expect that the relationship of displacement and force should be shifting from here to here and going back and forth and back and forth. And indeed, that effect can be measured. We can measure a hair bundle as it oscillates, rapidly take the derivative of this motion to measure transitions in the positive or negative direction, and then switch on a displacement clamp system that moves the hair bundle in a specific way. So here we see the hair bundle oscillating spontaneously. Then at this point, as it begins to move in the positive direction, the computer turns on the clamp, it moves the hair bundle to this position, it holds it, and it measures the force. And by doing that, it produces one point just after a positive transition. And by repeating this for different displacements, one can make the red curve. One can then make a similar curve following negative transitions, such as that one or that one. And what one sees is indeed the two curves are separate. So the curves are moving back and forth as the hair bundles oscillate. Here's another example. And the rate at which they move, if you measure the kinetics of this, has a time constant, again, of about 20 or 30 milliseconds, which fits with the slow adaptation process that I've shown you. So what is going on, I think, is this. There is a certain equilibrium value at which the adaptation motors would like to sit. Calcium coming through the transduction channel depends upon the open probability. And when the open probability is approximately 1/2, the motor is at equilibrium. However, as I've already said, the system cannot sit at this unstable fixed point. As soon as you put a hair bundle there, it will jump in one direction or another, say over here. When the system moves over there, the open probability now becomes very small. It's too low. So the system begins to shift with adaptation to raise the open probability. But at some point, it comes to the edge of this curve, which is an instability. It now must jump to this point. Now the open probability is extremely high. So the system begins to migrate in the opposite direction until it again becomes unstable. And finally, it's going to have to jump to the other side. So the system is constantly hunting. It's trying to find a position of equilibrium in the middle of this curve. But the instability, because of the negative stiffness, does not allow it to do this. So as a consequence, this apparatus can become an amplifier. And that's what I'll be talking about in the next set of lectures, next week's lecture. I won't go into the details now. But if you watch a hair bundle while you're stimulating it, a very small stimulus displacement at the base of the fiber will produce a much larger response in the cell. And that is despite the fact that the hair bundle is moving through a viscous medium. So there is some work constantly being done owing to the force of drag. And in fact, over a cycle of oscillating back and forth, this blue figure shows the total dissipation, the energy wasted to viscosity. But as a result of the movement of this curve back and forth, and you can see a family of these curves sliding back and forth, in each cycle, the hair bundle is constantly adjusting its force, and the total work done by the hair bundle is in fact this sort of reddish or orange solid, which almost is exactly equal and opposite to the blue curve. So the moral of this is that a very small external stimulus can give rise to a very large response because the sliding curve is constantly doing work and amplifying the signal that we put in. To conclude, the simple model that I showed you very nicely explains the spontaneous oscillations of the bundle. These are actual experimental records. These are the results of the model that I've just been describing for you. And so you can see that we can get high frequency or low frequency spontaneous oscillations just by adjusting a parameter value. If we spray calcium onto the bundle, the oscillations become smaller and faster, as we would predict. If we remove calcium, we see the opposite effect. If we apply increasing force to the hair bundle, again, the oscillations become smaller and faster. And lastly, we think that these oscillations are adjusted in our ear normally by some process such as phosphorylation. As some of you know, calcium works in many cells by interacting with calmodulin to make an active form. It in turn can turn on an enzyme called adenyl cyclase, which uses ATP to make the second messenger cyclic AMP. The cyclic AMP can then activate protein kinase, which puts phosphates onto various substrates. And in particular, there seems to be a phosphate target site on myosin 1C. So this is a speculation that this protein is actually phosphorylated. There are then two enzymes that are involved in deactivating the system. This one removes the phosphate, and this one breaks down the cyclic AMP. And there are fortunately drugs that affect many of these processes. So the drugs that are shown in pink will block the process that I've been talking to you about. Those that are shown in yellow will promote phosphorylation, either by inhibiting the breakdown or by promoting the formation of phosphates. And in fact, when we apply those drugs, we see that they affect the adaptation process and the oscillation that I've been telling you about. Those that cause more phosphorylation make the oscillations slow down, as you can see here. Those that cause less phosphorylation make slow oscillations speed up. And this molecule, butanedione monoxime, seems to block the myosin motors, and the whole oscillation process goes away. So the moral of today's story is that this elegant structure, the hair bundle, is really doing two things. On the one hand, it's an antenna. It's a system for capturing stimulus energy. It's an apparatus for transduction that converts that stimulus energy into an electrical response. And the electrical response can then excite nerve fibers and send information into the brain. But an equally important part of this hair bundle is that it is part of an amplification apparatus. It can use energy in the form of ATP to do mechanical work. That mechanical work can enhance the signal that the hair bundle is feeling. It can make the response larger than the input that's applied. And this turns out to be key in the marvelous properties of hearing that I mentioned to you before. The fact that our hearing is so sensitive comes about from the fact that the cochlea amplifies its inputs by 100 to 1,000 times. Our sharp frequency discrimination comes about from the fact that this amplifier is tuned to specific frequencies. The range of, that we can encompass in our measurement of sound comes about from the fact that this amplifier has what's called a compressive nonlinearity. It is very sensitive to small stimuli. It is not so sensitive to large stimuli. So with this apparatus, we can listen to a soloist playing a violin, but at the same time, we can also listen to a complete orchestra with 100 instruments. We compress all of that information into a rather narrow range, and our brain is then equipped to interpret it. So I'll go on next week to discuss how that comes about. At this point, I'll stop. I'll thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.